Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me on the Vigilance Press podcast. Tonight I have three very productive guests, one guest is actually going to be slumming it as my co-host tonight, Charlie McKelvey. How are you doing tonight?
I'm well, James. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Charlie is the creator of the WatchGuard book, and which is a supplement for Mutants and Masterminds, which is topical because we have two very special Mutants and Masterminds guests tonight. But really briefly, Charlie, you've got a Kickstarter running right now that you wanted to remind people about, right?
Yes. WatchGuard, as most know, if you read the introduction to the source book, is always intended to be a comic book, and the source book was, you know, served a dual purpose. But really, this is kind of the living of a dream, so to speak. So looking forward to getting this on the shelves in your friendly local comic book shops to go alongside what you can find in your friendly local gaming shops. So.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so we're looking to put pilot issues out there for Teen Force 5 and WatchGuard, and that's how we're doing it through Kickstarter.
Cool. What's the what's a good search term for people to look for on Kickstarter when they want to find it?
It should be pretty easy. A WatchGuard should be enough to get it up on the search or get a positive hit on the search. But Teen Force 5 would be another one. Three separate labels: Teen Force and the number 5.
Okay.
Either way, it should be pretty easy to find. Or they can just search me out on Kickstarter and there.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And tonight we also have two very important guests as far as Mutants and Masterminds go. We have the creator of the game, Steve Kenson. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well, James. Thanks.
It's good to talk to you again.
Looking Likewise.
Forward to Gen Con next week.
Yes. Yes, Gen Con time is upon us.
Yep. Congratulations. You're actually an industry guest this year, right?
I am. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. It's actually my first time as an industry guest at the con, so that should be an interesting experience.
Fantastic. And we also have with us the line developer for Mutants and Masterminds, John Lighthouser. John, how are you doing tonight?
Great. There, that was simple.
John's like,
good podcast.
John's like, and I'm out of here.
That's right.
Throws the mic down, walks away.
Everything I know about brevity, I learned from John.
That's your M&M moment, right? Where you just toss the mic down and walk off stage, you know?
That's right. I'm done.
Well, for Mutants and Masterminds fans who've been paying attention to the Green Ronin website, Chris Premus announced on their roundtable, the Ronin roundtable, they're publishing announcements for the rest of the year. And as far as Mutants and Masterminds, that included three major announcements, right? You've got they targeted November for the publication for both the Emerald City set and the fourth DC book, but they also finally named the mystery announcement for October.
Correct.
The October surprise. Yes. It's going to be the Supernatural Handbook.
Supernatural's Handbook. Now, I'm gonna start with that, and we'll get some details from you guys before kind of wheedling out some more details about the other stuff. But just to kind of start off with one of the questions that one of my friends asked, Rick Jones, who's one of our contributing writers as well, but he's also one of the guys on the podcast game, asked what makes this different from Book of Magic or Warriors and Warlocks?
Well, Supernatural Handbook is a source book by Lucien Solban, who wrote Hero High, which was one of our most acclaimed second edition source books for Mutants and Masterminds. And whereas Book of Magic was really all about comic book sorcery a la, you know, Doctor Strange and all of the various comic book sorcerer types who are primarily superheroes, and Warriors and Warlocks was more about fantasy comics like Savage Sword of Conan and Arion, Lord of Atlantis, and those sorts of things. The Supernatural Handbook is really about horror comics. And in particular, it's focused pretty heavily on monster hunting comics. So stuff like Hellboy or BPRD or Midnight Mass for folks who picked up that. Yeah, you know, those sorts of things. where you're dealing with characters, many of whom may have unusual abilities or may be supernatural beings themselves, who are dealing with all of these terrible and nasty supernatural threats that the world may or may very well be completely ignorant about. It's the, you know, it's like the tagline from BPRD, you know, when things go bump in the night, we're the ones who bump back. that's kind of what the high concept of supernaturals is all about.
Very cool. Now, I think I counted at least two people asking if there would be a Hellboy archetype, player archetype, in the suggested archetypes in the book.
There are a couple of monster, sort of good guy monster archetypes, mm-hmm. and it would be pretty easy to adapt something Hellboy-like out of it.
Cool. Yeah, I couldn't see you accidentally looking that one over or overlooking.
Yeah,
that's
not an opportunity we were going to pass up.
Yeah. So, with this book, what I know you guys before the podcast we were talking, and you said you haven't quite nailed down the specific price point or page count yet. But what neighborhood are we talking about? How big a book is it going to be?
It'll probably be about 140, 150 pages, mm-hmm. Give or take. Some of it depends on how it works out in layout, but in that neighborhood. So it'll probably be a little longer than some of the various genre books we've done before, like the various age books and the like, but not overly so. I'm taking a quick glance. So, yeah, a little longer than books like Hero High and Warriors and Warlocks, but not, you know, way off the charts by any means.
Cool.
In fact, Warriors and Warlocks is about 142, so it'll be pretty close.
Yeah, it should be in that range. I think Hal was saying between 144 and 160 kind of
60,
depends.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he lays it out.
Nice. So that sounds like there's a lot in there. Now, some of these books, you usually have some sort of nod or chapter or reference to Freedom City in there. Is there going to be a supernatural side of Freedom City, or are you going to do it with Emerald City this time?
Neither, actually.
Neither, yeah.
There is a setting element to Supernaturals, and basically it focuses on an organization called Arcade, which is an acronym that I can't remember right off the top of my head.
It's Arcane Research and Defense
of the Earth, sort of.
Right.
But Arcade is basically a secret organization, and super secret, in fact, because they have a specific ancient enchantment around them that actually makes it so there are only 100 people in the entire world can actually know about them at any given time. And basically about 75% of those people work for them. The rest are people who have to know about them, like the President of the United States. But literally, if 101 people find out, somebody has to forget that they even exist.
So very Men in Black.
There literally is a very limited window of how many people know about Arcade. The setup for it is a secret Arcade headquarters that was built in New Orleans, where, not surprisingly, there's a lot of supernatural activity. And it's a lot of discussion about how Arcade works and how it was set up and what goes on. And then there's some discussion about integrating Arcade into the Freedom City universe if you want to. You could set it up so Arcade is just the lone guys in their own setting fighting against the supernatural. Or they could exist in the Freedom City universe doing what they do with most of the world, including most of the superheroes and villains, completely ignorant of their existence because they can't – nobody literally can't know about them. Mm-hmm. So, some of the arcane or supernatural heroes and villains might have some awareness about them and what goes on with them, but the rest of the world basically wouldn't even know about them and their sort of secret you know, struggle going on behind the scenes. So you could kind of have it either way.
Yeah, I'm a kind of a big fan of that approach myself. Just it feels more like, you know, the 80s, 90s period of DC where I was reading, and you had characters like the Phantom Stranger and John Constantine operating in the shadows. But every now and then, they would kind of step out and connect with the Justice League on some level.
Yeah.
Like the issue of I think it was Swamp Thing, where the Floronic Man had gone nuclear and was
right.
controlling was all the plants the on the planet. World. Yeah. And the Justice League was standing helplessly by, wondering how they were going to stop him, and they didn't have a clue. But... you know, I do kind of like that idea that, you know, there's always something going on in the shadows, but that's just kind of my approach.
Mm-hmm.
So how easy is it to, you know, I'm assuming with most of these age books, the goal is to really kind of help you build an entire campaign or build a facet of a certain genre into your existing campaign. What's your favorite thing about this particular book? I'm assuming you've read it.
Yes. I actually did the primary development work on Supernaturals. I guess my favorite thing about it is where Lucien really digs down into how to run a horror-based game and how to make things scary. And you know, just how to address the idea of horror in a RPG setting, and how to really you know, do something that's a little different from superheroes fighting monsters, and make it something that's a little bit more creepy, a little much more scary. There's a ton of game master advice in the book about how to set that up and how to do it, and it's very atmospheric.
Very cool.
So, so one of the game GM devices isn't just randomly screaming in the middle of the game, is it?
I think one of them is to whisper.
Yeah,
just whisper.
Very cool.
But there's a lot of discussion about all sorts of different techniques. So,
yeah, there's a lot of really really good information in there that's about how to sort of maintain the feel and. To recognize, you know, first off, if your players are not perhaps a group of people you want to run a serious horror game with.
Right.
And there's a lot of really, really good information, and the arcade section is pretty nice because you can drop it in really to anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Any setting, I should say. And it is the American Research Center for the Arcane Defense of Earth.
The Earth. Thank you.
Very cool.
Sweet, sweet. It's kind of funny that that book happens to be coming out in October, where I'd kind of pegged my own Supernatural book to be coming out. So I don't know if that was serendipity or not. But
October is kind of the natural.
Yeah, the logical place to do it. I'm just trying to think if one of the things that some players tend to require from their horror games is a greater sense of danger. I'm assuming that one of the suggestions in the book, or one of the ideas in the book, is to incorporate the lethality rules, the optional lethality rules.
There's actually a section at the beginning of the chapter talking about how to set up supernatural games called series attrition. where it goes into great detail talking about the concept of how frequently should the players expect to be creating new characters, you know, this being something that the game master should talk to the players about, and that, you know, they should be prepared to, you know, go into the game knowing you know, that this is going to be a very high or, you know, mid-range attrition game, that they can, and, you know, expect to lose their characters, you know, in one fashion or another, whether it's to, you know, being killed or being turned into zombies or, you know, simply going insane. There are options for all of that sort of stuff in the book. all sorts of new ways create problems for the characters that will eventually take them out of their players' hands in one fashion or another. There's a lot of looking at that sort of thing in terms of how to make the campaign more horrible.
in a good way.
Yeah, and the other thing that Lucien also covers is a lot of power level options. So each he has a number of different kind of setups for campaigns in here. So, and then for each one, he breaks down like for different power level options. So he has for power level 3 to 5, power level 5 to 8, power level 8 to 12, mm-hmm. and he breaks down like what characters at these different power levels would be doing. So even in addition to the stuff Steve was talking about, you can have sort of a little more lethality or a little more fear baked into the setting based on like, we might be power level 6 characters who are taking on regularly threats that are much more powerful than us.
Right.
And the other thing to keep in mind always is people have this concept of a horror series necessarily having a high body count. But if you look at something like, especially Hellboy and BPRD, like there's not a super high body count in there. It's just that the threats they're facing are all very supernatural and big threats, but somehow they always manage to overcome them, even if, you know, something else gets screwed up in the same breath.
Yeah, that's very true. And the book likewise talks about the fact that it doesn't have to be a high attrition game in order to be a successful horror game. Mm-hmm. In fact, the high attrition if there is high attrition, may only take place amongst the bystanders. Mm-hmm. And it may be that the heroes are relatively safe comparatively, but that, you know, everyone around them is dying and going mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a question. I did remember in one of the previous iterations of Mutants and Masterminds, there had been some discussion about, I'm trying to think if this was the Masterminds manual, but there was some discussion about either powers or attacks that would mm-hmm. cause taint over time and eventually drive characters mad. Did you revisit that with this one?
As a matter of fact, we did. And a revised and updated and expanded version of that material is in Supernatural Handbook.
Fantastic.
Yeah, in fact, it's not even just taint, right, Steve? Because there's also
it handles all kinds of mutations and creeping insanity and moral corruption and all kinds of good stuff. Pretty much all the accumulation of bad stuff that could possibly happen.
If you could find it in a Lovecraft novel, it's got to be in there.
So someone wanted to put
I'm sorry, Charlie, I didn't catch that.
No, I was just going to say, or ask rather. I guess you could do some. You can have an umbrella organization and really have a Resident Evil type of a campaign where everyone and their mother twice is getting infected and so forth. That very cool.
Awesome. So, John, what was your favorite point that you'd like to call out for the Supernaturals book?
I'm sure we've already gone over it. I am actually also a big fan of the different archetypes in all the different books, just mm-hmm. because it gives a good feeling of like the sorts of characters you can play, and also makes it easy for somebody to kind of jump in, and play a character.
What power level ranges are you offering? just if you know off the top of your head,
I think these run from like 6 to 12.
Okay. Yes,
I see a massacre variety. Survivor at 6 and. An X-Cape at PL-12.
Yep.
Infected Hero at PL-10. So there's a pretty wide range.
Yeah.
One of the things that I tend to see, I think, a little more often in the Supernatural kind of comic books, it happens in books like the Justice League as well, but you have books where you have a lot of human characters and then one supernatural character. Do you call out the discussion on like varied power level among the player characters in this book, or do you just make up the power level with other ways?
There's not a lot of discussion about mixed power level groups, but largely because you're going to find that power levels may vary slightly between groups of characters where you have a supernatural character and a bunch of humans. But point totals aren't necessarily going to vary that much. And I think one of the things that a lot of folks might want to take into account when it comes to that kind of game for Mutants and Masterminds is that, you know, if you're, say, playing a power level 8 game and your guy is the team's techie, for example, your combat score, there's no rule that says your combat scores have to hit your power level caps. And, you know, oftentimes the easiest way to handle that kind of game is to say, well, yeah, the techie gets the same number of points, but all of his points go into gadgets and the appropriate skills and, you know, usually a ton of skills and intellect and all of that sort of stuff. And he just doesn't buy his attack bonus, you know, up to the power level limits because he's just not as good a fighter as the team's top fighter at power level 8. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it tends to be difficult in a point-based character design game to give one player more points to build a character than another and call that fair. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, honestly, I suppose in a group, if a player really wanted to build a character on fewer points, I wouldn't naysay them, you know, if that's what they really wanted. But I've never met that player who was like, yes,
I have not met that player either.
Please give me fewer points than all the other players.
Yeah.
You know, I have occasionally met the player who's willing to be good, have his character be good at the thing that he's good at and, you know, be okay with somebody else being better at something else. You know, and sort of the combined arms approach of, you know, characters having their specialties. But, you know, I think it's difficult to say, okay, well, you're the PL6 guy, and here's your teammate, the PL10 guy.
Yeah.
You know, and
although
and
you see that all the time in the comics.
You do see that all the time in the comics, but, you know, the game design approach has to address that in different ways.
Yep.
Yeah. So one of the things that popped into my mind while you were talking about the characters not hitting their skill cap or their attack and damage skill caps,
mm-hmm. Right.
Is that they're probably going to be focusing a lot more on the utility of skills. Which brings the question when you're talking about supernaturals, do you deal with any of the like some example rituals and other things? Do you go into ritual magic a lot more?
Not a lot more, but it is definitely discussed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, the basic honestly, that's one of those areas where Supernatural does rely a bit on other source material like Book of Magic, because there isn't a tremendous need to go into beyond the basic mechanics of how magic rituals work from the Hero's Handbook. Okay. And some examples of how to configure powers. There isn't really a need to go into a tremendous amount of detail as far as that goes, apart from mentioning it as an option.
Cool. All right. Well, you guys mentioned, I'm hoping that's enough for the, is there anything else about the Supernaturals book before we start pestering you about some of these other books we were talking about earlier?
I think that covers the essentials. It's going to be a very meaty book. There's just, there's a lot of material in there. So anybody who is a fan of the genre or is looking for a change of pace type of scenario, for their ongoing game should really check it out.
Cool.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other thing the book also has, and we discussed the kind of hero archetypes, but there's also a ton of like monster templates, both templates and archetypes.
Archetypes,
and you can kind of layer the templates over the archetypes to get different combinations of things, or add different mm-hmm. archetypes, or add different templates together to really make some interesting bad guys.
Cool. Do you have any more Rockstar vampires? I couldn't get over how much Dracula looked like.
Well, there's another version of Dracula in the book, and plus it also has one of my favorite archetypes, the metrosexual vampire.
Yeah, I was just
in the book. So
awesome. actually call him out as the metrosexual vampire?
Yes, he's
vampire?
Actually called the metrosexual vampire, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
My favorite archetype is still the one that Lucien calls WTF.
Yep.
That's the archetype's name.
That's great.
So,
all right. So, now Emerald City. I'm gonna jump over to this topic here. When you guys originally started talking about it earlier this year, it was going to be a box set. Now that's changed. You guys are going to release it as a slipcase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this book actually has shape changing. It originally started as just a normal book, like just like Freedom City was. And then we were like, hey, you know, the Dragon Age thing did really well, and people seem to respond to the box set, and it would be cool to be able to do that. So let's change it to a box set. So then I was developing it as a box set with two different books, The Player's Guide to Emerald City and The Secrets of Emerald City. And then we talked to, I don't know if it was something to do with, taxes are higher on
part of it was Europe.
Box sets in Europe. And so if we do a box set, then sales in Europe would probably suffer and people wouldn't actually be all that interested in it. Because it's apparently a pretty significant tax.
Yeah, it's pretty steep.
You know, I was talking about the European taxes, and my European friends can catch me on this if I'm wrong. I don't remember which country it was, but there's actually a tax on cookies. I think it's Germany, but I want to double check that.
Is that why they call them biscuits?
Yes. I mean, actually, there was a cake-like cookie, or a cookie-like cake, rather, that was being released where they did a tutorial video explaining why it was not a cookie and should not get the cookie tax.
Oh.
So, I mean, wow. You know, it's like the fact that it's not, you know, it's like cookies get a luxury tax, whereas cakes do not.
Yes. This is the same as Marvel's legal case where they made the legal argument that the X-Men are not humans because figures of human beings are taxed differently than figures of magical and fantasy creatures.
Oh, wow. I never heard that. That's fantastic.
Yes. Yes, but the X-Men are not humans, and therefore their figures cannot be taxed as you know, figures of human beings.
Interesting. So the slipcase. Now, to me, I'm a very big fan of slipcases as opposed to the box. I actually like that. I think that's an upgrade. Is it still going to be the two books, like the player's book, the GM's book, and the map, or how is it going to be broken up?
It'll be three books and a map. So it'll be the player's guide, the secrets, and the collected Emerald City Knights series.
Ah, very cool.
So that's how we're getting that into print. And so kind of the idea with this box set, or with this slipcase set, is to kind of give people, here you go, you can run a campaign or a series completely out of this single product, as long as you also obviously have the Hero's Handbook. And then you're ready to go, like you're off and running. That's what you need. So you've got an adventure, you've got characters you could use so that players don't even need to write up characters if they don't want to. You've got the setting that, you know, they've got a book they can look through to learn what they need to about it to write up a character if they want to write up a character. And the GM has both that book and the secrets that gives him more information on the background and what's gone on in the history of the Emerald City setting and where things stand now, including villains, etc.
Yeah.
Very cool. Now, last I heard, you were still looking for the artist, I think, to tackle the city map. Have you found an artist, and who did you end up working with?
We did find an artist, but you asked me that now, and I have no idea who the person is. Well, it's one of those things, like, Hal handles all the ordering of the art and all that sort of stuff. I know it's someone we've used in the past, and I wish I could remember his name.
Yeah, and his work is great, too.
Yeah, it was looking really good. But I haven't, I off the top of my head, I don't know.
Would it be similar to the street maps from the Freedom City book, or is it going to have a different look to it?
I'm sure it'll be a different look.
Okay. Yeah, it's a somewhat different style, but I do really like the guy's work.
Yeah, for sure.
Very cool. John and I have been seeing, you know, samples of the maps with you know, just to get a sense of they're getting the right feel, and the cartographer definitely gets the overall look of the city.
Cool. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing those maps. I think it was the second printing, or maybe the original first edition of Freedom City, but it was one of these books where I opened up and I saw this really big city map, you know, with all these streets labeled and everything. And I just went, that's really cool. To me, yeah. That's one of the things that made Freedom City come alive for me, because I could actually say, well, this car chase is happening down this street, and that's going to run into, you know, like Burn Avenue or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was really fun, because it took you into unexpected territory, and things like that offer ideas for, you know, it's like, wow, he's running right past this site, which is really, you know, connected to this other superhero. Maybe this is a great opportunity for like a crossover or something, you know. It's just something that would happen.
Yeah.
But I think maps have that power to really kind of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. His name's Sean McDonald, by the way.
Super. Oh, you found it. Good. Okay.
Yep. And yeah, he's been doing a really great job with putting together the maps. He's been doing a master city map and a bunch of smaller blow up maps of key areas.
Yeah,
I think that
it'll
be safe to say that Emerald City will have more maps in it. Freedom City, honestly, we had that big master map, and we had a couple of small blow-ups of parts of that, but we didn't have quite as many location maps in Freedom City as we do in Emerald City.
Ah, interesting. Cool. So what makes the book Emerald City different in style and construction, aside from you're talking about you have a lot more locations called out? Is that like a major difference between the two books, or are there other differences between the way that you approached the two books versus Freedom City versus Emerald City?
John, you want to take that one first?
Well, I mean, the only things that I really would have to say, I'm sure I've said in the past, in terms of the, kind of the overall approach to the design of the setting, we didn't have all the different kind of hero archetypes and different niches filled in the world like we did in Freedom City. This is a much more wide open city. But then in terms of, you know, the actual doing the development, I guess it was a little different because we had, well, actually, Steve, in Freedom City, did you have like a secret section in the back of the book of like what was actually going on?
We ended up doing that in the second edition,
okay.
Where we collected a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. But unlike Emerald City, where it's a separate book, so you can hand the you know, guidebook, the visitor's guide to Emerald City, to the players. Just give mm-hmm. them the whole book, and they mm-hmm. can look through it. So they're actually separate books.
Yeah. So that was kind of one of the big things is. When you do sit down at the table, you've got a resource for the players and a resource for the GMs. And, you know, they may need to refer back and forth between the two books, especially the GM. But, you know, the players won't be looking in that secrets book. Well, you know, I say that, but probably without the GM at least being aware of it, or, you know, it kind of depends. I think the set will be of interest to people no matter what. But certainly it has much more utility for a GM. Than a player, and you know, players, I assume, are going to want to read the whole thing regardless. And
now, one of the major things about the Freedom City book was that it really did lay out a lot of characters and a lot of history for the setting. Mm-hmm. You know, how does Emerald City compare? Are you guys going to be? I think I've asked this question before, but I've had some people ask it again, so I thought it was worth mm-hmm. re-mentioning. But how are you guys going to be revisiting the history of the setting, and how many characters do you think you'll really be offering through the book? I mean, ballpark.
Well, I think that the best analogy is that Emerald City is much more player focused. My one big regret about Freedom City was that honestly there were too many heroes in the setting. I think it makes Freedom City interesting to read about, but I think it makes Freedom City tricky to play in, you know, in terms of there being a lot of heroes around. Emerald City isn't like that. in the sense that Emerald City is much more like the Marvel Universe during its first few years, when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko were in the process of creating it. So it's pretty wide open. There are a ton of villains around, and plenty of plot threads and ideas for GMs to pick up, but pretty much no other pre-existing heroes if you don't want them. We have the Sentinels as sample heroes, and a bunch of options about whether you can use them as an existing hero team or as solo heroes who just happen to be around, or even as villains. Or use them to supplement and fill in, you know, gaps in your own hero, you know, group, if one of the players just needs a character right off the bat and really likes Princess or Xeno or one of the existing characters. But they're not so integral. They're very lightly integrated into the setting, so that if you took all of them out, nobody would really miss them in terms of the way that works. So the history stuff in Emerald City is it's a little less of the where the history of Freedom City is basically the history of American comic books, you know, for all intents and purposes. The history of Emerald City has a lot of secret history to it. There's still plenty of weird stuff in Emerald City, but until recently, nobody knew about any of it. It was all behind the scenes. It was all kept hidden. It was all covered up. So for the most part, there's very little feel that, oh, this is a setting where there have been active superheroes for years and years and years. Instead, it's been the setting where for a very long period of time, nobody's really given it much thought. Oh, it's Emerald City. It's a quiet, nice place to live, and nobody really ever thought about it. And then all of a sudden, this stuff started happening.
So, and that stuff being, of course, the big Silver Storm and the ensuing adventure. I think the last chapter of that just came out last month, or a month or two ago,
but yes, yeah. Just recently.
Yeah. And that's one of the great things about the set is the stuff that changes Emerald City forever and makes it into the place that we describe is also included in the set. You know, the first series is basically the thing that changes everything in Emerald City. And you know, the characters get to be there when it all happens, rather than it all being stuff that happened, you know, a while ago.
So, of course, a lot of people really do love the Freedom City setting, you guys are kind of bumping the timetable forward a little bit. I think you said about 5 years.
It's real time.
Mm-hmm. So the idea, the question then becomes, how much of the Freedom City, how much information are you going to give about what's going on over in that other town? While the players are doing their heroism in Emerald City,
not a lot.
Most of it, there's not a lot of it. But what is in there is, and mostly because we didn't want to be developing both of the books at the same time, because there would have been a lot of back and forth to try and coordinate with that. But the Freedom City stuff is going to be covered, obviously, in the Freedom City book when that comes out, or set when that comes out. We don't know exactly what form it's going to take.
Yeah.
But there is some stuff mentioned, like there are companies that are shared between the two settings because they're in the same world. There are some characters that have moved around, and you've seen some of that even in the
Hero's Journey.
Yeah, the Hero's Journey, especially in the Hero's Journey, and also in the threat reports, like we've dealt with Tolona and her relation to Black Vulture and a couple other bad guys as well.
Yeah.
That just fit really well with sort of the Emerald City aesthetic. So there's not a ton of it, but there is some, like we certainly refer to things that are in the Freedom City setting in Emerald City because it's all part of the same world.
Right. Right.
So is, you know, now you've mentioned, you know, that you guys have been thinking about at least working on the Freedom City book. Is there any development started on that, or are you guys still mostly focused on getting Emerald City done and out the door before you start working on that?
Certainly that second one. Okay. Much more involved in, because we've got the DC book that we're working on. We've got the whole bunch of different stuff. But Freedom City also, thankfully, is mostly developed. Now we just need to advance the timeline and see what we want to change and update. And I think that'll be pretty relatively easy compared to some of the other things that we work on.
True. Yeah, I mean, Freedom City is more of a simple remodeling. You know, rather than building something from the ground up, you know, we're just going to, you know, implement some of the stuff we've already done and, you know, make a few, you know, necessary changes here and there to reflect, you know, the passage of time. But, you know, one of the ideas about the Freedom City setting is that it's fairly timeless in some regards. So I don't think that folks are going to find the new edition of Freedom City is drastically different. You know, we're not blowing it up or, you know, anything like that.
That's a great idea.
Nuke it for more, but it's the only way to be sure.
I think that, you know, the design goals for the next iteration aren't going to be drastically different from, you know, what we've already seen as far as that goes. If nothing else, because we don't want to have to, you know, do a new map. Because we love
there was a big explosion and they rebuilt everything exactly as it was.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Metropolis could do that.
Yeah, that's true.
He's done it already.
That's true. You heard it here first, folks.
All right, very cool. So, now you did mention the DC Adventures book. That's the final in the four book set. That's going to be the DC Adventures Universe book, right?
DC Adventures Universe. Yep.
Okay. What's the shape of that book going to be?
Square.
Well, rectangular, I would say, but yeah. No, it's going to be very much like the other books in the series. So we'll have some really nice cover art, and we'll have it's actually very few chapters in the book. I think it's only 5 chapters.
Yeah, but keep in mind, one of those chapters is entitled The Universe.
Yeah, exactly. And other times. And, you know, that's
the other one is entitled History. Or what is it? One's The Future, which is also my favorite other chapter.
Oh, I thought I had the outline here, but I must have.
I mean, it basically breaks down into what, like the past, Earth, the universe, and the future.
Yeah,
something like that, and like another section on other dimensions. So I mean, each chapter is fairly substantial.
Yeah, I imagine so. It's a big playground. Any idea how many pages, or you know, what neighborhood we're talking about that yet, or is it?
I don't know exactly. I know in my Word document here, it's 213 pages. But I don't know exactly what that will map to in real world pages. I'm fairly certain it's going to be thinner than any of the 3 previous books. But that is not to say that there are not plenty of characters and plenty of information in there.
Mm-hmm. It'll still probably be about the size of the Hero's Handbook, I would think.
I would think so. I'm just looking them all up on my shelf here, and I was looking at the 3DC books, but.
Right.
Yeah, it might be about the size of the Hero's Handbook.
Okay.
But yeah, it'll still be pretty substantial, and it should be a good read, because there's a lot of, I think if people are looking for some obscure characters, this is going to be the book that they really want to look at, because it's got Black Rock and Kular Warriors, which we talked about a little bit earlier with Charlie off the air. A bunch of different stuff that it's like, okay, now I have to make sure that all these write-ups actually reflect what the characters
is where we put a lot of the obscure historical characters and stuff like that when we were first compiling the lists for heroes and villains and, you know, working our way through our master lists and allocating page count to everybody and figuring where they would all fit. Mm-hmm. We had to cut a number of characters, and we tended to focus on the characters who especially didn't have a place in the modern setting. So, you know, a lot of the, you know, like World War One, World War Two, Wild West type characters.
And even I mean, they eventually made it into the Heroes and Villains book, but even originally, like the Warlord whole cast of characters was in this book.
Was going to be in the universe, yep.
Yeah.
So you'll find a lot of the sort of time-lost characters in that book as well as a lot of the aliens and the cosmic stuff.
Old fun stuff. Yeah, I love the extended DC universe. That's probably my favorite thing about the setting is all the crazy stuff that goes on in the cracks, between the cracks of reality.
Mm.
But, so, let's see. We've got those books slated for November. That's the DC Universe book and the Emerald City book. Is that going to be are you targeting the print for November, or is that going to be the PDF, or how do you know, what's the progress on that? Do you guys know?
I think the target is print. I think my fear is it'll probably just be the PDF, but we'll have to see how that goes. I'm working really hard to try and get that done so we can get it out in November like it's slated, because Steve did a great thing and took over the development of the Supernatural
you were talking
book
about.
Yes, just a minute ago, the Supernatural handbook, and so he did all the development work on that so I could concentrate on all the DC and regular M&M stuff, and so now I'm kind of forcing my way through this DC book right now, and there's a lot of characters in there, so it's going to take me some time.
It's
thankfully I'm not going to be editing this book. I'm going to send it out to somebody else to do the editing. And I can just concentrate on the stat blocks, which
anybody,
do take
a anybody I know that I might like look over his shoulder.
No, in fact, I don't know who's going to edit it right now. We had Sharon Mulvihill, Sharon Turner Mulvihill, I should say, edit the mm-hmm. second Heroes and Villains book, and the first Heroes and Villains book was by I know who it is, Fred, right?
Fred
Gantz, right?
Yeah,
and. So he did that first book, yep. And then I edited the Heroes Handbook.
Right.
So I don't know if I'll get one of them to edit this or if I'll find somebody else. I don't know. It kind of depends on what people's schedules are like, because mm-hmm. I need to get somebody to work on it pretty quick. And it shouldn't take too long to edit since it's a fair number of characters.
So editors, John's email is john
exactly.
at reading.com.
Exactly.
Yeah, Nathan, jump on that. I had to.
I'm sure Nathan has all the time in the world too.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Guys, actually, it's like, man, Nathan, don't. I need you focused. But I really have to say that when I first took over Vigilance Press, one of the things I tried to do, because you know I have done editing myself and thing was try to wear too many hats. And
do you want to do some editing for me?
Well, I certainly wouldn't mind putting some eyes on these projects and, you know, giving you some feedback. I don't know that I can be as good as someone like Nathan is. He's clearly got magic powers when it comes to editing. I've actually gone through manuscripts and done what I thought was a pretty good editing pass, given it to him, and it came back with all these changes that are just like, wow. I never even saw those.
Yeah.
So I mean, he's definitely got the talent and the skill to do these things that I don't. So there are people who have these very specialized skills. You know, I mean, you can be a good writer, and you know, people like Jack Norris, great writer, but you still want to have a great editor in your corner.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
They do so much for you. So it's you know, I totally understand. Subcontracting that out to somebody who knows what they're doing, you know,
yeah, really definitely makes a difference.
So, so I'm really looking forward to the DC books, you know, to having that final chapter. I'm going to ask, just because I know someone out there is going to be wondering, after the final or after this fourth book, is there any plans for any further DC Universe or DC Adventures products or material?
No plans.
Okay.
Sorry, so. Peoples. we would
I'm sorry. We'll have only given you the complete game. all of the characters and the complete world. So that's pretty much it. That's all you get.
I think the only question left would be, will there be adventures or anything? And I think as much fun as it would be, I think
Yeah, unfortunately, it's just, and part of it is because our licensing agreement with DC is for 4 books.
Right.
So, for us to do additional product like adventures, it would involve us negotiating a new licensing agreement.
Yeah.
And with things being as they are with DC's current publishing plans, ultimately best for us to just leave, up to the individual groups and, just point to the fact that, every character in Heroes and Villains is a ton of adventure hooks. The universe book is going to be full of adventure hooks. The fact that you can pretty much adapt any superhero adventure you wanted to DC pretty easily. But to produce adventures for something like DC just wouldn't be economical.
Yeah, I mean, these characters, you were talking about adventure hooks left and right, and all I can think of was, yeah, they're like adventure Velcro.
I mean, yeah.
It's like, somebody shows up and automatically there's a story. These characters, they kind of write things themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Adventure Velcro sounds like one of those other terms you just coined there, James, that needs a little C ding at the end.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you need to get, paid every time somebody uses it.
Yeah, I need to get Jack Norris to sit here and just start, sending off, contracts or something to copyright notices on all these things that I come up with, because clearly my ideas are so golden.
Exactly.
Which is... right, yeah, I'm honestly, folks, I am not that egotistical. But there's been a lot of great stuff this year. You guys just released the threat reports. You guys have all these great books coming up and towards the end of the year. How do you guys feel about, you've been doing a lot of stuff digitally for the past couple of years with the Mutants and Masterminds line especially, and then turning around and kind of doing print versions of the digital stuff. What's the response to that? I mean, are you still seeing a lot of strong sales for the print versions, like the print version of the threat report? Do people think that maybe there's not as much urgency to grab the book if they already have the PDFs?
I don't think that's the case. There's certainly a growing market, and I think a sizable market and a growing market for the PDF stuff. But the classic way people buy games is in printed products, and I think that's going to maintain for a while longer, at least. Mm-hmm. We might sell, a few hundred copies of any of the PDF products, but that does not compare to the sales level of a printed book, which is in the thousands.
Yeah, I was going to say it's an order of magnitude different.
Yeah, yeah. So it's still the printed product that currently rules the roost in terms of kind of sales model still in our industry.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's going to flip-flop at some point, but that's
yeah,
what it is.
We try to make an effort to add some value to the printed product as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like with Threat Report, we made sure to, add some additional characters into the book that were, brand new. Hal worked, some of his layout magic with the design of some of it, reformatting some of the introductory material and, just sort of polishing the overall look of the product. So, we try to make sure that the print product is not just, hey, we printed it all out for you.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to insinuate that, but it is kind of an interesting thing to see the shift, because when I first got into Mutants and Masterminds, it was only available in bookstores, and I think the first PDF you had released, if memory serves, was one of the last products you had published for the first edition of the rules. I think it was the Gimmicks Guide.
Actually, I'm pretty sure it was it Gimmick's Guide or was it Lockdown? I thought
it might have been Lockdown.
I think it was Lockdown actually.
Because we really was Edition 2, wasn't that?
No, Lockdown
it was both.
Yeah, actually, Lockdown was released as a first edition PDF, but that was never done in print. And then print version was done for second edition with a revised PDF for it as well.
Okay. Okay. I don't think I ever saw the first edition PDF, so that was just me missing out on that one entirely. But no, it's really interesting to kind of see the change, and I like, you know, it's like it's really cool to see a new product coming out every week, like the Power Profiles, and I'm really looking forward to the Power Profile compilation when the book comes out.
And that's actually for me, that's the biggest thing is like. Mm-hmm. Being able to deliver something on a, well, basically weekly basis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We've been a little bumpy recently on some of those, but that's because we have just too many things in the pipeline currently. But yeah, being able to like get something out to people on a fairly regular basis to say, hey, look, you know, this game line's still alive, going strong. If you want to buy something, here it is. You got something new every week.
Yeah.
You know, and we know these products aren't individually going to appeal to everyone, but I think overall, like in the series with this, the Power Profile series, if people aren't familiar, each one covers a different power in that you can, or a different power
type.
Source, different, descriptor that you can write up a character around. And I think it's really handy because new players can look at it and go, hey, I have an idea for a shape changer. I want to try and do that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a complicated character to write up. So I'm going to pick up this Power Profile and it gives me some information on my writing up my shape changer, my summoner or my water user or, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I think that sort of thing is really useful.
Yeah. Yeah. And the great thing about, you know, the format of things like Power Profiles is that each one doesn't have to appeal to everybody. You pick and choose the ones you like. You know, and if this week's Power Profile doesn't really grab you, well, maybe next week's will. You know, and that's one of the nice things about that format is it allows us to do these little bite-sized pieces of content that people can – that can be really focused and that people can really use immediately but that don't require quite the same amount of development as a full-sized book.
Mm-hmm. Cool. One of the print products that you came out with very early on in the life cycle of the third edition of the rules was the quick start guide to the that went along with the the lovely Game Master screen. John, I think you had mentioned at some point that you were talking about releasing a revised edition or a second printing on that.
Yeah, at some point we're going to do something with it, and that project has not yet been announced. But I actually have Leon Chang, who is my co-author of that, looking at his sections to give me whatever edits and changes he wants to put in place. So we're already kind of half-heartedly working on that, and it should be pretty cool. I think people will get a kick out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, it always kind of interests me when we go through the various power profiles and kind of compare them to some of the builds from the quick start guide and you know kind of go back and go, wow, this would be a really cool idea to slip into that somewhere. Is there going to be anything like that, or are you guys going to pretty much, you know, stick with just editing and clearing up any math errors?
I think it's mostly just going to be editing and math errors.
Okay.
We're not gonna get too ambitious because it's just one product in a line of many. So
yes,
yeah,
cool. All right. Well, aside from Mutants and Masterminds, I know Green Ronin publishes a couple of other things. Did you guys want to make any shout outs to some of your guys' other lines real quick before I?
No, we're in direct competition with them. We don't want them to sell well.
Exactly. They're sucking up all of our resources.
Wait, no, that's not right. That's not.
That darn Game of Thrones
exactly
TV show that you turned into a game, you know.
Yeah.
Well, like,
go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was going to say for Song of Ice and Fire, we've got the Night's Watch book coming up. And man, is that book going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's really
It looks fantastic. The cover of it is super atmospheric, and it really, you know, it digs into how to run a completely different kind of Ice and Fire game.
Yeah.
You know, that is really divorced, well, sort of divorced from all of the courtly intrigue of the Seven Kingdoms, and is really all about just the harsh life of, you know, being a black brother on the wall, and like, well, welcome to the rest of your life, however long that may be. And, you know, dealing with everything that's beyond the wall. And we get a really great look at some of the you know, sort of supernatural side of the setting. So it's just, it's a terrific book. I think that people are really gonna eat it up. I mean, it's great stuff.
Cool. I do have to admit that, you know, I've not really paid a lot of attention to fantasy role-playing games in until recently. Once I started watching the Game of Thrones TV show, I started looking at that going, you know what, I really need to swing by the Green Ronin booth and grab the game, because there's a lot of, you know, this world is really cool and I want to learn more about it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, yeah, when is that Nightwatch book coming out?
See, that's where you run into the, September. Hey, this is other people's stuff.
Oh, yeah, not bad.
Yes, so September.
September? Yeah.
September? Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well,
cool.
Is there anything else you guys wanted to give a shout-out to before I unleash you on the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, you know, and folks can check out Chris's column on the Roundtable for all the details as far as things go. And the only other...
And that's just on greenronin.com,
that's
right?
On greenronin.com. Yes. And, you know, the other big one is Dragon Age Set 3. And, you know, that's where we're looking towards, you know, the end of the year, beginning of next year. So, but it too is going to be a really kick-ass product.
Cool.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Well, it was great having you guys on. I'm going to go ahead and let you go. John, are you going to stick around? I know Steve Kenson had some stuff he needed to take off and do.
I'll probably take off as well. Although, okay. I feel bad that we made Charlie sit there that whole time and not get a word in edgewise of it.
No. Seriously, you're talking about the fanboy, and he's just there drooling, so I'm biting my chin now. But no, really, I think I'm excited, so it was a blast.
Awesome.
Fantastic. All right, guys. Well, John, Steve, thanks again for joining you, and I look forward to seeing you at Gen Con next week. Steve, yeah. Did you want to you have a schedule that you want to point people to if they want to try and see you?
Oh, yeah. For folks who are going to Gen Con, you can go to stevekenson.com. I posted my Gen Con schedule up on my blog for people who are wondering what seminars or other guest of honor type things I'm doing while I'm there. And otherwise, Green Ronin is at booth 1201 in the exhibit hall. And that's home base, so that's pretty much where I can be found, where John can be found, and all the various Ronins will be. So come by and check us out.
Are you guys rubbing up against the Filkers again this year, or
no? We're
right in the front of the hall this year. Yeah. So
fantastic.
Yeah, no, we have a great.
Yeah, remember you guys were tucked away in the back last year.
We actually have a pretty much the opposite version of our space from last year, so yeah. It really looks nice. Pretty sweet.
Cool,
very nice position.
I'll be looking forward to seeing you guys then. All right, well, thank you very much for both joining us, and I will see you again soon.
Great. Awesome. Sounds good. See you.
Take care, guys.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
We still have Charlie McKelvey, who I roped in as sort of my co-host, but I wanted to give you a chance. We've actually been trying to put this podcast together for all week, but I've been so busy with artwork that and wrangling my last-minute Gen Con plans that this is the only time we had to get you together. So this is the second part of tonight's podcast. We're going to be talking to Charlie. He's going to be telling us about a bunch of other plans that you've got coming up for WatchGuard. You've been gearing up for Baltimore Comic Con, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So while you're in Gen Con mode, I'm in BCC mode, and it's no less hairy, I promise.
Well, I'm going to be at both, so
Oh, that's true. A point noted. I defer to you, my friend.
But honestly, one of the things that I really liked about BCC last year, aside from getting to hang out with you, and of course Jesse Justice.
Yes. Yeah.
It was a very different energy from the crowd. Gen Con is very gamer-oriented. You have a lot of people kind of being very critical of certain things of what you're doing. They're very embracing of other things. But at the Comic-Con, I got a lot of just really enthusiastic people who just loved comic books and were kind of interested that we were doing something different with them. And that was kind of a fun perspective.
Yeah, so. See, that's what I've always loved about Baltimore. I mean, Heroes Con is probably, just from a raw Comic-Con perspective, it's my favorite that I've actually boothed up behind. But Baltimore, to me, is just – it's a much more diverse group, and they're all very – like they just want to check out new stuff. Like they like the stuff they know, and they like the traditional, you know, the have you drawn Superman? Oh, great, I want to talk to you kind of guys. But then, like you know, already talked about, is you get those people go, hey, what's this all about? You know, when they stopped by our booths last year, you know, it was nice to be able to talk with these people and share actually some about the gaming that they actually didn't even know really existed. So a lot of people didn't know there was a superhero gaming system, and that was kind of neat for us to kind of introduce the Vigilance Press stuff and the WatchGuard stuff. So, yeah, I agree. It's one of my absolute favorite shows.
Yeah, I was in, and again, last year I didn't even have printed product. I just had some printouts of our PDFs and things to show off. I didn't have the content, but it was also kind of fun that, like, while we were sitting there, I had Jesse Justice designing the Lantern logo for Vigilance Press.
So, I remember that. I was like, yeah. So when it hit the web, right, I was like, there. I saw that when it was a baby.
So, yeah, thanks again to Jesse Justice for that. He's done so much good work for us in logo design and also illustrating the upcoming book for Jason Tondra, The Forgotten Five. Of course, the name doesn't come immediately to mind because they're the Forgotten Five.
So you almost forget the name.
Yeah. But which is a really cool Do Vigilance product, and we're gonna be putting that out shortly after the Six Gun product. And for those of you who've been watching, I've been posting a lot of artwork to the Facebook and other social media, but we've just finished a lot of artwork on what. I'm hijacking things. I'm sorry. We're supposed to be talking about WatchGuard.
No, but you're talking about stuff that I'm excited about. So what do I care, right? No, I mean, I will plug it for you. Listen, guys, if you haven't seen the art, it's gorgeous, and in fact, so much so that I had to go and hire a couple of the artists myself for upcoming projects for WatchGuard. So no, it's a perfect segue if you want to get back to hosting. Go out there, check out the Six Gun stuff, and I think the Forgotten Heroes is going to be awesome.
Yeah, Six Gun is actually what I have. Alex Williamson has been doing a lot of artwork for us recently, and he's just a machine. He's incredible, and I know that he started working on some stuff for you, and I can't. I don't know if we're allowed to talk about that. Are you allowed to mention? Okay.
Oh, sure. So, in fact, I posted Freediver on the official WatchGuard Facebook page. So if anybody wants to see, you know, just the pencils, and design of a new character for the WatchGuard universe, Freediver fits in a different location, which people know about. I'm working on a Canadian supplement called Les Supérieurs, or the Superiors. I kind of wanted to, you know, to rip off the Ultimate's name without doing so directly. And I wanted to pay homage to one of my favorite groups of all time, Alpha Flight, you know, especially the Burn era. And so so that's where Les Supérieurs come from. They have a French name, even though they're based in Manitoba. Yes, I recognize that Manitoba does not speak a lot of French, or Manitobans. The reason that the name is French is because the headquarters of the organization that oversees the group is in Toronto. So it is in French-speaking, or Quebec, rather. It's in French-speaking Canada. So it does make sense. I'm not completely retarded when it comes to Canada. It does help, though, that I have an anchor who lives in, British Columbia, so you know she's helped me out a little bit and kept me straight. So.
Cool. Now that's something that a lot of people don't necessarily see when they're fans of comic books, comic book art versus I think role playing game art. I think a lot of role playing game artists are used to doing the entire job by themselves. And a lot of comic book artists are used to, like, carving things up. You get the penciler, the inker, and the colorist are all different people. And a lot of that has to do with the assembly line concept that you have, you know, you have to get this artwork out in kind of bulk without sacrificing quality. And so, you know, every person becomes very specific at his job. Whereas over in the role-playing game industry, most artists work alone. So I come from that first mentality where I'm used to the idea that, and I actually haven't had a chance to work with people that much before, but I'm used to the idea of portioning jobs out and dividing things up. So it's been kind of interesting to try and get my other friends to some of whom are good at this and are familiar with that process, and some of whom are basically going, wait, you want me to ink somebody else's stuff, or you want me to color somebody else's, and getting used to that. So people like Dan Hauser jump right in, and they're really good. He's just really has a lot of fun playing with other. I mean, that was how we met, was that he inked and colored a piece that I'd drawn, and we made an instant friendship that way. But you know, some people, I'm not going to name names, but some people are just, you know, that's not how I would have drawn it. And they get hung up on that.
So, yeah, and I think what I see, and I did that with the WatchGuard source book. When I first put that together, it was, I did it with the comic book studio assembly line mentality. I'm a production house. I'm a, you know, call me whatever, pick a name. Don't use a big name because those guys are way better than I am. But, you know, my big goal as a writer slash editor creator is, really, like, let's get the right people for the job. And well, the nice thing is keeping some of the same inkers across different pencilers does maintain a level of consistency. And I think that's one of the biggest compliments I ever got on the WatchGuard piece was, I love how consistent the artwork is. And I had, I don't know, 30 artists worked on that book, maybe close to it. I don't remember off the top of my head, but and they ranged all over in special areas of specialty, and some crossed over, some did both, you know, and whatnot. So I think it just produces a little bit more of an organic piece, whereas sometimes doing a lot of the stuff yourself, and you see it in indie comic books, a lot of indie. And I'm not, by the way, I'm not being pejorative or negative about those things. I'm just saying sometimes they come across a little static, like there's not as much emotive reaction because it aligns, because it's all done by one or two guys, usually just one. Mm-hmm. And I like the organic feel of a studio where everything's kind of growing together.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of like having two blueberry bushes, and you put them side by side, and you get better blueberries if you have two of them rather than just trying to grow it off one. I mean, that's just the nature of the thing. So to use a plant metaphor.
Okay, that's way out of my league.
Yeah, sorry. I obviously grow blueberries.
Very cool. I've eaten blueberries.
Bring you some to Baltimore. So,
but one of the things that I think that it lends itself to, and again, I think people are going to start noticing this with the Vigilance Press products, but this is something you got right off the bat, was your characters have a very distinctive comic book look throughout the entire book, and that was very eye-catching to me. That was the moment, mm-hmm. I kind of picked up your stuff and flipped through it and said, oh gosh, I want to be a part of this. Because, this was kind of how I look. Now, as much as I love, like, Mutants and Masterminds as a game system, and I love that they have fantastic artwork, and they had color artwork that grabbed me right off the bat, one of the things they don't really have, a consistent style that runs across the top, because they are actually picking and choosing artists from lots of different sources, but most of these artists are working on their own. Now, I do know that in second edition, a lot of my friends at a local art studio, Revolver Studios here in Atlanta, did some artwork for them, and they did include some artists who had worked on things like Superman and Wolverine and people like Dexter Vines and Tariq Hassan
Andy Smith. Andy Smith, who's a good friend of mine and mm-hmm. one of the lead artists on Andy had done Mutants Mastermind stuff before. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but one of the things that I noticed is a lot of these people were working not in their usual methodology. So the artwork, instead of looking like something you might see in a comic book, was more like this one artist's style from pencil all the way through to color. And it doesn't necessarily blend with other images. So you have to, you know, you kind of have to have a good layout guy who's knows how to use this artwork, you know, and every individual piece looks good, but it takes, you know, a good eye to kind of draw a through line through them, you know, and use them well. And one of the things that we've been trying to do at Vigilance is find a good, you know, and you're going to see that there's like some inconsistencies in our current batch of products because, you know, there's some experimentation going on behind the scenes with who I'm using and who I'm matching up with who. But a lot of it kind of gelled when Alex joined the team and started doing art for us because he has such a strong, like 1980s, 90s inker
yes.
style. Very, very strong. Very kind of John Byrne era, I want to say.
Yeah, he's got a Ron Frenz kind of a feel to it. And I really love that because, you know, of course, you know, I built my book based off the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. So having that Ron Frenz-esque kind of an ink, almost the Al Williamson type thing, or Al Milgram rather. Yeah, I'm with you totally on that one. And I, Alex, I think you guys are going to love what Alex is doing for WatchGuard too. It's going to be really fun.
Very cool. So, aside from the Les Superiors, the Superiors, because I'm not going to pretend to butcher French.
No, that's okay.
aside from them, what other plans do you got? Now, I mentioned very briefly about your Kickstarter at the beginning of the show. Let's talk a little bit about that real quick. You're actually raising money to produce not one but two comics. Is that correct, or is it going to be one comic with two teams in it?
The answer to both those questions is yes. So okay. I'll clear up the nebulousness of that, and their ambiguity rather. So I, like you've already alluded to, I'm a huge fan of 80s, 90s comic stuff. It's when I grew up. But there's also kind of an ambiance about those books that just isn't there all the time today. Some books capture it really well, and some books just totally miss the mark, and some books don't care to because they're modern books and they want to be modern, and that's great. So we all have our bailiwickets, and what I'm trying to do is for those who own the WatchGuard source book, you know that my goal was always to publish at least a comic book, if not a series or mini series. And so the Kickstarter is all about funding any of the remaining art that might come up as necessary. For example, exclusive covers. I've got two alternate covers being done right now as we speak by Ray Anthony Height, who's worked on books for Marvel and I think Ape and Boom and other organizations, Xenoscope and whatnot. And so stuff like that to pay for those things or to supplement the pay for those things, but really to get the production and printing costs out of the way. There will be a book, going back to the original question. Initially, it's going to be a singular book. That's the goal. It's going to be a flip book style. We haven't seen a flip book probably since the first Youngblood back in 94, late 93,
oh, yeah.
94, right? So I haven't anyway. And I've been reading comics forever.
Now when you say flip book, an animator thinks one thing, but you mean something
yes.
different.
So a flip book in comic books would be that you have one cover that you look at on the shelf. It's like you do. You pick it up, you flip through the book, and it's like a normal comic book. Until you get about halfway through, all of a sudden pages are upside down. You go, what the crap? And what it is because if you literally flip the book over vertically, you have a new cover that's oriented properly, and those pages are aligned to that cover. So you actually have two stories. Imagine if you picked up two comic books off the shelf, turned one upside down, and put them, you know, back to back, and glued them together. I mean, that's kind of the essence of what a comic book flip book would be.
Cool.
So WatchGuard, this pilot issue that the Kickstarter is all about, was always the goal. And the success and popularity of the source book has really driven me to say, I've got to do this. And that and Andy Smith, the artist for WatchGuard, was like, you got to do this. Finally, just do it. It's good to have friends to prod you on. But Teen Force 5 proved immensely more popular than I ever intended. I wrote them as just kind of a fun homage to, you know, 80s, 90s teen characters and everything. And well, as you know, because Vigilance picked up the license for Teen Force 5, and that was the first license you published, right, with the Teen Force 5 Icons product.
Yep.
So...
And that will be that is pretty much the lead in to the entire WatchGuard book. But yeah, that was the we picked that chapter first just because I have a very great fondness for those characters. And it might have been a tactical mistake because we didn't cover the setting as well as we could have if we'd focused on the setting area. But I just really liked the team. They were my favorite thing about the book.
Thanks. And again, you weren't the only one. So yeah. That actually forced me to go ahead and say, well, I'll write their origin, so to speak. So so out of that comes the Teen Force 5. It's quasi-origin, actually, because the story that's being told in this pilot issue that's on the Kickstarter is for the Teen Force 5 side is the origin of how they became Teen Force 5. But unless you've read the bios for all the characters, you don't really know how they became together as a team with the first three, because when you get into the book, there's already three of them that are banded together as Teen Force, and they're already kind of fighting the bad guys and, you know, righting wrongs and, you know, fighting injustice and so forth. So, and that'll be penciled by Kevin Sharp, which many of you, you know, already know. If you don't, he wrote recently did Nova number 25. He drew that with.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So if you pick up Nova number 25 from Marvel, you'll have Kevin Sharp soup to nuts. And Diana Greenhalgh, our anchor, is, like I said earlier, she's the Canadian to which I alluded earlier. She and Kevin, that was, as far as I know, that was their first published work together, Nova number 25 for Marvel. So if anyone wants to get an idea of the quality of art you're going to see in the Teen Force 5 side of the book, go buy Nova number 25. You can get it on Comixology or whatever, but it's going to look at least that good. But I think Kevin's really, with the pages I've seen, and I've shown some of them on Facebook and on Twitter, the pages I've seen are just stellar, some of Kevin's best work. So I am dying to see this whole thing done. It's gonna be great.
Fantastic. It's exciting. So I've been kind of watching you and kind of charting your course and watching what we're doing over at Vigilance too. So we're very hopeful that the Kickstarter takes off. How much time do you have left on that Kickstarter, and where are you at right now?
As of the time of the recording, we have about 23 days left, so just over 3 weeks. And we crested over $1,000 that first week, which is positive. It's encouraging. It's slow. So I think the thing is just getting the word out. I didn't really broadcast it too much before I posted the Kickstarter, so that was really kind of quote a James term, a tactical error on my part. But I'm fervent. For those who have been watching our Facebook pages or Twitter feeds, I'm fervent right now, just making sure I put the link out there so everybody sees it. So by all means, go to Kickstarter. You can look up Charlie McElvey or WatchGuard or Teen Space Force Space number 5 or whatever, some other search, you know, algorithm you want to use, and find it. And please pledge. You know, a buck is great. You know, a dollar is great because that moves us forward. That's all it takes. $5 gets your name in the back of the book, so you'll actually be on a thank you page in print. And $15 gets you an exclusive cover, a Kickstarter exclusive cover to the book, and you'll get it before it hits comic book shelves. And you know, if I have, it's not promised to be autographed on there. I plan on autographing them if I have an opportunity, if I have time to do so. It'll be exclusive. The only way to get the Kickstarter cover will be through the Kickstarter program. So go out there and pitch in and help Team WatchGuard get on the shelves.
Very cool. Very cool. So, to kind of switch gears a little bit, is there any other big WatchGuard announcements you wanted to make? I mean, outside of the Superiors book and the. Weren't you working on something else? But I wasn't sure if you were ready to announce it yet.
Yeah, and in fact, on the Atomic Think Tank, I've actually thrown out there what the overall plans are. So there is a supplement that is it's grown, and the problem is it's a cosmic supplement. Now, we were talking about that with John and Steve, you know, them doing the cosmic setup for DC. And it's massive. I mean, just to work on a cosmic, and I got alien races, and I've got new heroes, new characters. I've got new worlds to be developed. So there's a lot going on there. But it's the final title is going to be WatchGuard: The Rise of Regent. And some of you have actually seen the artwork for Regent, and you can certainly Google him or hit up on DeviantArt and go find the design and drawing. Actually, the full colored piece for Regent's entry. He is dynamite. I mean, he's just, first off, it's a gorgeous character. I mean, he is just a stud. And and power level wise, he's off the charts. I mean, I think when Leon did his numbers, he worked out to be like a 15 or 16. So he's a silver surfer class character, and he is every bit as evil as a Thanos or some other character. He's not as megalomaniacal as Thanos, so he's tripping over himself. So that makes him even more dangerous. So I'm looking forward to that. That's good. That's fun. But yeah, the Rise of Regent is in process. It's much slower than I anticipated originally. We've got new aliens that keep popping up in my head. And so that means new worlds to be written. And consequently, we had Steve Perrin and Claire Conti and a couple other writers who have pitched in to help out getting some of those worlds written for us. So that's great too. Which is the first time I've expanded out more than just the adventures to get some of the writing done. Usually I write the whole book, and then D.T. Butchino or the like would actually write the adventures for me. But yeah, I had to sub these out because it's gotten too big.
Yeah, I was really happy to see that you got to work with Claire and some of the other folks. You had pitched out to me asking me to help, and I'm like, I am so busy. So I immediately turned to a bunch of people that I basically were like, these are people that I would be working with right now if I had the time to work on their stuff. And unfortunately, some of those worked out. So it was really good to see.
Yeah, and I'm immensely thankful together for that. So I appreciate your help on that, James.
Oh,
really.
Okay. I was just connecting you with people I liked, so I mean,
it worked out for everybody.
I don't necessarily call that nepotism, but
we're all brothers, so I guess it is, right?
Yeah, right. But
I did talk about before releasing a separate Teen Force 5 supplement, and I've actually backburnered that mainly because they seem popular enough to, in some senses, they're actually helping to sell the WatchGuard source book. So it's almost kind of rape sales, I think, from the WatchGuard source book, and really kind of rob the fans of greater pleasures. If they like the Teen Force 5 and they want to buy the whole book, then I think they'll enjoy that more. Mm-hmm. So I keep growing the Teen Force 5 story, and it may still end up as its own supplement later. Mm-hmm. But for now, I'm back burner that project and just focus on the rest.
Have you thought about doing any like one-off adventures or things like that?
Yeah, well, I haven't thrown that away yet. I have considered actually kind of the threat report model. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great little. So maybe have some guest writers pitch in every once in a while and do those kind of things. But frankly, I'm enjoying the threat report so much that I would feel kind of dirty if I just jump in there and do the same thing. Who knows? So it's possible.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that, we have coming up are the Devilish Duos that we've published two of them now, but, we plan to be publishing a lot more that are like a threat report, but focused on two characters that work together. And, they're kind of that's for our Vigilance Press, line. And then of course, the Do Vigilance line that people have been seeing kind of grow over the past few months. It's the original release for that was of course the Octoberman that came out, and then we've since scaled it up so that we could go to print and start doing real books. And one thing I've noticed is that once we started kind of figuring out all the fiddly bits with that, everything else started coming together a lot faster. So we've got a lot more books coming up that'll be PDF releases initially, and then further down the line will be released. We're not going to be doing this simultaneous. We're not going to be focusing on the simultaneous release as much coming up. But one of the things that we are working on is the complete WatchGuard Icons translation. We're going to be doing a complete book on that. And anyone who bought the or has bought, because I'm not cutting this off at any point until we make we've got the book ready to launch, and I'll make an announcement about it then. But anyone who bought the Teen Force 5 for Icons, the initial WatchGuard issue 1, will get a pretty deep discount on the WatchGuard collection once we release the full Icons book. And That'll be fun. And when you've got the Cosmic book and the Le Superior, we'll have to talk about making sure that we can try and get the Icon stuff out as soon as we can.
Yeah, well, what I'll do is actually, you know, and I'll just let everyone know that what I'll try to do is as those are finished and we're pretty sure that the editing is done, I can flip that over to you with the artwork and you can go ahead and begin your processing on it so that they kind of tail right behind it if it works into your schedule. So that won't be such a grand distance between the releases. That would be mm-hmm. beneficial, I think, for both. I think Icons is a great, you know, format, and I'm glad you're doing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's another game by Steve Kenson. How can you go wrong?
I totally agree. I was, like I said earlier, I was a total fanboy just listening to him talk earlier. I felt like such a nerd. I was just sitting there going, oh, this is great. So, anyway.
I'm glad I've actually gotten a chance to get a little more comfortable around him because, you know, I still there are very few people in the world that kind of make me switch into that hero worship mentality. But when I first met him, I definitely had that kind of buzz going on in the back of my head going, oh, my God, that's Steve Kenson.
Absolutely.
But I mean, terrifically nice guy, super easy to hang out with. Anyway, the upcoming projects that I wanted to let people know about, one of the things that I was segueing into is we were talking about Alex Williamson. He just turned in, and I just finished coloring the last pieces of artwork for a free product that we're going to be releasing called the Challengers. Oh, now, cool. To fill people in on what this is, the Challengers are going to be a group of 8 power level 11 superheroes that are designed as player characters. They are part of a much larger product that's being written by Jack Norris. And, you know, he wrote the characters as well, although I did have some input on some of them. And a little bit more input on one than the rest, but I contributed. One of the characters was actually my player character, the one I play in my home game, but that was just my own little vanity character there. But
no, he wouldn't do that. He would do this. I know. I've used him.
Yeah. But in this case, you know, we've put the artwork together. Ruben's in the process of doing the layout. It's already been edited. I think Jack's going to write a quick introduction that we kind of overlooked, kind of explaining the connection. But it's part of a much larger project that we're probably looking at a Kickstarter for. And I haven't punched all the numbers together, but we're looking at a Kickstarter to raise the money. It's probably going to be about, I'm looking at about 150 pages, probably final product.
It's a nice book.
And, yeah, so we want to have full color illustrations on the inside and we want to have a, it's going to be a really big, it's essentially a campaign in a book and, it's called The Elements of Ruin. And through the course of the campaign, your characters will be fighting against an evil force that basically becomes a mega event. It's you know, and part of it is not just the specifics about these characters and about this setting, but it will also be optional rules that you can bring into your campaign to help you run an event scale storyline. You know, so it'd be you can call it a mini campaign if you want to, or you can use these kinds of things. It's very, I want to say it's inspired a lot, but we actually started conceiving of this before Jack started working for Marvel. So there's a lot of, you'll find a lot of similarities to some of the way that Marvel does its event writing. But that's just cause some parallel evolution was going on there, but you're going to find some other stuff in there that's completely different too. And this is all going to be for Mutants and Masterminds. We'll probably do some conversions of some of the characters and stuff and some of the rules down the line. But the first book, we're going to be focusing purely on Mutants and Masterminds. I'm going to kind of target in a vague way next summer for the full production of it. But the actual book itself is, you know, Jack is in the process of outlining. We've got a lot of the villains and the characters already worked up. Some of the characters have already worked their way into my podcast game, the Beacon City campaign. And Beacon City will be a setting outlined in the book. It will be but the book is not limited to it, and it doesn't require you to run it in Beacon City. The point of having that in there is so that you can just get started and start playing with the materials in the book, and you don't need anything else except for the Mutants and Masterminds rule book to get started. But we'll talk more about that in future podcasts. But right now, it's a really big project. We've been working on it also.
Did I lose you?
Nope. Oh, sorry. Did we lose you there, Charlie?
No, I'm here. Okay. All I said was I lose you, so there you go. I guess that was fair.
Okay. Because I've been talking. But basically, that's the Elements of Ruin book, and the Challengers are a preview of that. And they'll be player characters, and they will be a free product available on RPG Now. As soon as the layout gets done, I'm kind of hoping that it'll be ready by next week, so that people – I can announce it, you know, at Gen Con, and people can run home and download it for free. So
you should have them download it on their iPads.
Yeah. They can download it on whatever they want to. Their phones, their Androids, whatever. I don't care. I'm not racist when it comes to technology.
You know, you can't be, right? So the you just reminded me, actually, the supplementary stuff or ancillary stuff is – I also just remembered that I think we're in the final throes of getting our Jupiter statue finished. So you may see her if you come to Baltimore. Yeah, full color. She is just flipping gorgeous, if you didn't know. And if you didn't know, where have you been?
Jupiter – now is that going to be released – I mean, I could not remember. Is it going to be colored when you buy it, or is it something that you actually buy and you paint yourself?
Yeah, so she's going to be a resin kit, and it'll be unpainted. Now, I'm talking up the painter now, the guy who's working on it right now, Sean, to see if he's willing to take commissions and to do that sort of thing for people. So if you want a full cover one, we'll have options for you. But, you know, part of the joy of resin kits for those who are resin kit enthusiasts isn't just the piece itself, but it's the assembly and the painting, kind of putting the personal touch on it. So we're kind of going for her now. That's where we're going with that. But you asked a great question, so that segues into the next thing. If you go to the Kickstarter, you'll see that one of the rewards is it's currently a work in progress, but there's a Sentinel statue coming. Sentinel is by far the most popular and more recognized character of the Watch Guard. I think partly because kind of the resonance of Captain America or any other patriotic hero there, but also partly I think because he's of mixed heritage, and I think that really kind of resonates with people in general, because, you know, in a sense we're all kind of different in our own ways, and that's a good thing, right? I think he represents America in such great ways because of he's a living melting pot, but he's also a patriotic character. He's got a war history, but he's not, you know, like all pro war. I mean, so, you know, he's a really cool character because he's a patriotic character without agendas, which is kind of rare. And so anyway, and he looks cool, I think. But so that's one of the reasons people really like him. So he may actually be at Baltimore as well. I'm not sure if he'll be painted at that time, but I'll have the prototype with me at the least. Should have that at Baltimore, barring any kind of molding issues. I may have a few for sale. They will definitely not be in color at that point, but we're working with the production company to produce full color packaging, styrofoam package encasing inside, 6-inch tall Sentinel statues, and they're being by David G. Rowe, who did a Colossus bust for Sideshow Collectibles.
Sweet.
So, and he did one
good stuff.
Oh, and he did for Sideshow Collectibles. If you want to get an idea how great David is as a sculptor, he's a great guy too, by the way. He has a Snake Eyes piece where Snake Eyes is fighting three or four ninjas. It's this huge piece on Sideshow Collectibles website. It is absolutely smashing. You see that piece and you get an idea of the quality that's going to come out of the Sentinel piece. So both of my sculptors are phenomenal guys and awesome sculptors. We're going two different routes. I'm going digital with Sentinel, and Jupiter was done in a traditional fashion. So we'll see, you know, kind of what you guys like.
Cool.
And she's going to be massive, by the way. She's 16 inches tall from base, base to the top of the boulder that she, or meteor that she's catching. Wow. So she is huge. Yeah.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, I think
Oogler or Oogler.
Yep. I think we've stretched the patience level of our audience enough for tonight. So I think we're at about almost 2 hours now. So
sounds like two episodes.
I'm gonna mix it up into one super mega episode because I won't be here to post it next week. So hopefully everyone enjoyed us rambling on and talking about WatchGuard and Vigilance Press products. Recently released, just to remind everybody, we did release we've got three books on Amazon and CreateSpace now. You can find the links on the Vigilance Press website. If you want to look up any of our art, the Challenger's art is on our gallery, on that gallery page. If you go to vigilancepress.com and mouse over the gallery, it'll pop up with a menu of galleries you can look at, and Beacon City Challengers is right at the bottom. You click on that, you can see all of our full color artwork for the characters in the Challengers, and you can comment and tell me which ones are your favorite. I know I have my own personal favorites, but I'm biased.
As well, you should be, Dad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, as far as the artwork goes, my favorite characters are not the ones I created, but I actually really liked Dreamweaver. I did have a hand in creating her. I really liked her, but I loved the way Bounce came out.
I like Viridian. She just is cool. I love her look.
Yeah, Viridian?
Yes.
Yeah, she's actually my player character, and that's the one I created.
And so the secret is out.
Yeah, that was the one that I actually used her as the exemplar for our metas project too. So she'll kind of be popping up as a power level 10 version there. But you know, I have the power level 11 version that we used for the project here. So you get two versions of it. But this one again, free. It'll be a free download on RPG Now. It'll be available soon. If not next week, then hopefully before the end of August at the very latest. And then the future products coming up, we have Six Gun and Forgotten Five coming up for the Do Vigilance line. And shortly after that, we should be able to make some announcements about the old school mutant future kind of Gamma World background that Darren Drader turned in the manuscript for. So we've got that, and we've got a pretty big, awesome set of surprises, and I will actually tell you what's going on if you stop by our table, and Bug Dan Hauser and myself, I'll probably give you some sneak peeks at some of what we're doing ahead of time, but we've got some new media coming out. We're breaking into some new territory with the Mutant Future thing and with the Beacon City Challengers. But we'll talk more about that soon.
You need to tell everybody where to find you at Gen Con.
Yeah, you need to come and find us. Dan Hauser and I will be hiding out in the Anime Artist Alley, which is actually across the street from the dealer's room area and most of the major stuff. It's in a hotel across the street. I believe it's the Westin Hotel. And if it's the same place it was last year, and it's the Anime Artist Alley. And because I tend to, you know, when I'm drawing my fan art and stuff, I'm actually go back to my old anime roots and draw, you know, all sorts of anime characters. But if you want to have yourself drawn as a superhero or ninja or whatever, please stop by. We'll be sketching away and doing some artwork, and Dan's bringing his printer, so he'll be coloring the stuff, and we'll be doing digital prints right there at the con, so that'll be fun. And we'll be there on and off for the whole convention, so that's Wednesday all the way through Sunday. I'm going to see if I can't break away and find some opportunities to run some games, but at this point we're going to be spending some time. I know Dan's got to do some demo games as well for Icons, and he's going to be hanging out at the Adamant booth as well doing some signings. So we will try and have someone at the table there all weekend, but there may be some times when you stop by and we're missing an action. But we shall see. We shall see. But thanks again for tuning in, and I look forward, Charlie, to seeing you at Baltimore. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to you again before that and see where we'll be at. But I'm hoping that we're sitting next to each other again. I haven't got back on this. I haven't heard back on the seating arrangements for Baltimore.
I haven't either, and we'll talk offline about other projects and stuff like that. I've got logos for the show, so if you need them, let me know.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks again, everyone, for tuning in, and until next time, stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.